directors of the Castle Centre for Human Rights Law. Before I start tonight's proceedings, I want to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Tonight we have a special presentation by Shui Meng Ng, who is going to talk to us about the issue of disappearances, and in particular the disappearance of her own husband. But there's a lot of much broader issues triggered by that particular event that made us keen to host this session tonight. One of them is the human rights issue of enforced disappearances per se. As many of you may know, the Convention on the Elimination of Enforced Disappearances is one of the core human rights treaties that make up the international system, but it's one of only two that Australia hasn't ratified, the other one being the Migrant Workers Convention. No prizes for guessing why Australia hasn't ratified that one. But that is by way of saying that this is an issue that ought to be at the centre of human rights discussions around the world. It's still a pressing issue, particularly in our region, in the East Asian region, and yet it's one that gets pretty much neglected, and including by us. We've never had an event by enforced disappearances before. So we're very happy to have our very first enforced disappearances event tonight. The other issue that it opens up discussion of is the sort of environment that we find in the Asian region, and a region that's got its own human rights challenges, particularly in the region of Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, around that area. Issues of difficulty for civil society in operating in those areas, difficulty for human rights advocates, and difficulty for advocates of development, that is, advocates for community. And at the same time, all sorts of land grabs and crackdowns of anyone in dissent. So it's a very difficult environment in which to operate. It's also, in many countries, an area of rapid change. So to try and tackle all of these myriad of issues, which are, of course, completely intertwined in this case, we'll hear tonight from a panel of three speakers before opening it up to questions. First, we'll have Andrew Nettie, who's sitting in the centre of the table here. He's one of the organisers of Shui Meng's visit to Australia. He will start by introducing Shui Meng and setting some context for the situation in Laos. Following that, we have Shui Meng herself speaking on the disappearance of her husband, Son Phuon. And following that, we have Andrew Beswick from Amnesty International, who will talk about enforced disappearances in general and particularly about Amnesty's work in the region, which will tie up some of those other issues I've been talking about. So I'd like to introduce now Andrew Nettie, who will, as I say, set the context before introducing Shui Meng. Thanks. Okay.
Thanks, Adam, for that introduction, and thanks to the Castle Centre for Human Rights Law for hosting this event. I'm one of the organisers of the speaking talk for Shui Meng that's been taking place in Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne over the last week. The tour is hosted by the University of Sydney Social Justice Network and has been funded by the Charlie Palmer Fund. Charlie was a friend to many of us. He was someone who was a person who worked for a long time in Laos. He died, unfortunately, several years ago, and a sort of trust was set up in his name to do work around the Mekong region. And a number of us who were involved with that trust thought it was a good idea to use some of that money to bring training out. An issue I know that would have been very, very, very close to Charlie's heart, as it is to all of us who are involved in it. I've just spent the last 3 days with Shui Meng in Canberra. We did a similar event to this at the ANU. We visited the Basin Parliament House, lobbying Australia to take a much stronger stand on the case of Son Phuon's disappearance. Shui Meng's husband, who's been missing now for 15 months. I was just asked to give a little bit of context about Son Phuon, his disappearance, and events in Laos. So I might just do that very quickly, and then, of course, I'll give it over to Shui Meng. Sompat was born into a poor farming family in Kamawan province, which is in the sort of centre of Laos, sort of south centre of Laos, in 1952. He was the eldest of 8 brothers and sisters. He received a scholarship to study at the University of Hawaii in the early 1970s, where he graduated with a BA in education and an MA in agriculture. Now, he returned to his home after the establishment of the Lao People's Democratic Republic, and his earliest work was demonstrating low-cost methods of improving farm production and food security. Now, it's important to sort of note, going back to Laos, Sompat was really swimming against the tide. Laos had been devastated by a very lengthy civil war, of course, with the involvement of both Vietnam and America, and had been the target of one of the most intensive US aerial bombing campaigns in history. So the communist government that took power in 1975 was an international pariah at that time. Educated Lao people were fleeing the country. The country was literally devastated, but Sompat chose to go back anyway and help them rebuild. He pioneered the use of participatory rural appraisal techniques in Laos. And in 1996, he was given permission by the Ministry of Education to establish the Participatory Development and Training Centre, PADEC, to provide training for young and local government officials and community-based development. Laos is a one-party state, as you will know. Well, you may not know, but it's a one-party state. It's intensely suspicious of independent civil society organisations, particularly independent obviously Lao civil society organisations. Sompat was able to navigate this, not for this, because he knew how to work in Laos. He always worked with the government. He was widely recognised as a leading humanitarian and community development worker in Laos, and in 2005 he won the Ramon Magsaysay Award for Community Leadership, which is sort of Asia's equivalent of the sort of Nobel Prize, or one of the Nobel Prizes. Now, he met Sriming when they were both students in Hawaii. Sriming had come from Singapore, subsequently worked for the United Nations in Laos for a long time, and between 2003 and 2008 he was the UNICEF representative in Timor-Leste. In mid-2012, Sompat retired from his position as director of PADEC. He intended to spend more time with his family, meditating and writing. He was last seen in Vientiane on the evening of Saturday 15th of December 2012, when he was driving home in his jeep. He was stopped at a police checkpoint. I'll leave Sriming to go into some of the details. Stopped at a police checkpoint, another car appeared, he got into that car, he was taken away. His family and friends immediately contacted the police, visited hospitals and informed embassies, but no one knew where Sompat had gone. 2 days later, CCTV footage became available that showed that process, that sequence I've just described to you, of Sompat being stopped by police, another car pulling up, Sompat getting into that car with flashing lights, driving away, and then the jeep subsequently being driven away too, and he has not been heard from since. Now, no one knows why he was abducted, and despite a major international campaign by donor governments and NGOs for his safe return, and Sriming's own incredibly exhaustive efforts to find out more, the only official statement made by the government has been to state that it is investigating the disappearance and deny any involvement of the part of the Lao state in the disappearance. There's also been a lot of rumour, hearsay, smear, and other things that have gone on around that about what may or may not have happened and the reasons why it happened. Now, it's interesting to note, with the exception of the official police report into the disappearance, not one word about Sompat has been published or broadcast by the local media in Laos. Indeed, I think it's pretty clear his disappearance has led to a significant chilling effect across the entire stance of Lao society, civil society. People have been told not to mention his name. People are scared. People believe, perhaps rightly, that if Sompat can be disappeared, no one in Laos is safe. Now, I'll stress that this is my view. I don't want to put words in Sriming's mouth. The Lao government statements repeatedly to any diplomat that asks, including Australian diplomats, and many have, is that it is investigating the disappearance, has no new information about the individuals responsible for the act or Somwat's whereabouts. They've also, as I say, thrown around smear and innuendo about what might have happened. Now, it's my opinion that that lacks absolutely any credibility at all. As I said, Laos is a one-party state. It's a small country with a very big security apparatus that spans the central government all the way to the most remote village level. Nothing of consequence goes on within the borders of Laos without the government's knowledge. Again, I want to stress this is my view. It's inconceivable that the Lao authorities have not been able to find Somba or bring to justice the people who took him. The only reason they have not done this is because the state has made an active decision at the highest level they don't want to. Now, this has been compounded by the Lao police's failure to conduct a thorough investigation. Other countries' offers of external assistance, including analysing the original CCTV footage, have been rejected out of hand. I think America's made that offer, the EU has made that offer, I think Australia's made that offer as well. Now, Somwat's disappearance has focused international attention on Laos, obviously in an extremely negative way. It has really raised questions about the success of other countries' efforts to encourage the Lao government to protect human rights, about the role of overseas aid and development assistance. This is particularly the case for Australia. Australia is a major donor in Laos. I think we're the biggest donor in education and water and sanitation. We are, with the exception of Sweden, I believe the only Western government that has maintained continuous diplomatic relations with Vientiane after the change of government in 1975. The focus of much of our effort in Laos, in Australia, has been to get Canberra, the government, parliament, to leverage this relationship and take a far more proactive stance to pressure the Lao government to secure Somwat's release, or to find the people who are responsible for his disappearance and secure his release. Just a couple of other very brief comments about this case. I'm not an NGO person, I'm actually a writer and a journalist. In my previous life, back in the 90s, I worked for a number of years in the Mekong region. I worked in Laos for several years. And later I was a volunteer for a Thai environmental organisation that worked in Laos, Cambodia and Burma on land, water and forestry issues. I didn't know Somwat well. But during my time in the region, I met him a couple of times and I heard him speak on many occasions. And he was one of those people, and other people have said this too, who even if you met him only once or twice, he had a profound impact on you as a person. I've sat through Shui Ming talking about her husband countless meetings over the last few days, bureaucrats and politicians, a process that she has approached with considerable patience and quiet dignity. And in the process, I've been repeatedly struck by the fundamental injustice of this situation. Not just the human rights violation that comes with the enforced disappearance of this person, but the possibility that elements of the Lao state would seek to remove someone who has contributed so much to this, to the country. It's something that I think needs to be given more prominence, and it's something that the Australian government and other sectors really need to have a much more proactive stance on. So with that, I might pass it over to Shui-Min for your comments.
Thank you and good evening, everybody. And thank you to the Caston School of Law, for Human Rights Law, for hosting the event tonight. It's been an exhausting week for me, but I am thankful for the interest of all the people who have expressed to know more about Somwat's case and learn more about his disappearance. I particularly would like to acknowledge the contribution of the Charlie Palman Memorial Fund. Charlie Palman is a dear, dear friend of Somwat. And it is through the generous support of the fund that I'm able to come here. I've spoken at various universities publicly, and today in Melbourne, this is where I will also briefly talk to you about somebody. Andrew has already introduced briefly about Sambat. I'm here for two reasons. I'm here to visit my family. I have relatives here. So I use the opportunity also of being in Australia to address an interested audience about the case, but also to advocate support from the Australian government and also the good people of Australia to do what they can to help me find somebody. As Andrew has said, in the past few days, I have focused my talk around getting people to understand more about Sambat the man and his work. As Andrew has in his introduction said, Sambat, like so many Laotians, is a child of the soil. He's a farmer's son and he grew up poor. He experienced war. He also experienced what it is to struggle for a living as a farmer. So he is very, very knowledgeable, as well as he understands the struggle of common farmers. He's not idealistic. He knows it is important to develop the country, and he supported the government to develop the country. He also experienced war. He was born in 1952. So as a child, he grew up during the so-called Vietnam War. In Laos, it was a secret war. And as a child, he was a refugee for a while, for about a year, where his family had to live in Thailand to escape the fighting going on in his village. So this had influenced his life, being a farmer's boy. He chose to study agriculture, and as Andrew has already said, he studied agriculture, but he also is not a blind copying of modern science or modern agriculture. He's very much tuned into the needs of his own community, and this is why he has always tested various appropriate technologies before introducing them broadly to other farming communities. This shows him and other people working on testing technologies like alley cropping and use of green fertilizer. He has also a very strong respect for indigenous practices and local wisdom. He always believed that you could not have survived farming if you did not know about what to do. Not like some agriculture specialists nowadays who come in to walk straight into a developing country and say, we can teach you what to do. Sambat never did that. He always tried and learn and listen first. And that has always been the way he works with other people. He's a listener. He doesn't talk very much. He listens first. In the early years of his work, he focused on agriculture. But later, he started working across different segments of the population, knowing very well, very segmented sectoral work is very limiting. You can't change. You can't change the entire society. And as he worked, he became more and more interested in working with young people. The reason he was very much interested in working with young people is that because he believes, and he through his own experience working with young people, he believed that the young are more receptive to changing ideas and changing ways of doing things. And that's why, after he founded the Participatory Development Training Center, a lot of his work has focused on education and youth development. Sambat has, through his life, always been open to new ideas and influences. When he was a student, when we were students at University of Hawaii, when the war was winding down, but nonetheless, as students, he participated in the days of moving, trying to work for peace, and he knew how devastating the war was. Among the friends we had were Quakers. The Quakers are known for their pacifism, nonviolence, and social justice. So he was very much influenced by that approach. Enough war, he says. Enough war, enough bloodshed. How do we rebuild our devastated society through peace? Irrespective of which side of the political fence you may be during the war. So he always said, enough of fighting, enough of violence. Let's rebuild the country using peaceful means and also promoting our social justice. Laos is a Buddhist country where the majority of the people are Buddhist. And Sombat was, very, of course, influenced from young with Buddhist teachings. But he always said he's not a Buddhist scholar. He is much more interested in the concept of engaged Buddhism, using Buddhist teachings to engage society, communities, to learn from what the Buddha teaches. The Buddha teaches respect for life, learning from truth, discovering the truth yourself. And that is what he had focused. He worked with many engaged Buddhists in Thailand, especially Ajahn Sulak, who is a well-known Buddhist thinker in Thailand. He read widely the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Buddhist leader, and also the Dalai Lama. He was also very much interested in the last 10 years on the concept, the Bhutanese model of gross national happiness, where the discussion of development is focused not only just on economic development, but on general well-being and happiness of the society. And through his teachings and learnings, he proposed this model of development, what he called a balanced model of development. Sombat never objected to economic development. He felt that economic development is very much needed. You needed to grow the economy, you need to get jobs, and you need to get people out of poverty. So that is also something he has stressed. You need to have economic development. That becomes one of the pillars in his model. But more importantly, he says, economic development cannot be at the expense of ruining the environment. And particularly in Laos, where people depended so much of their living on nature, on the land, on the forest, on the rivers, on the ponds. So he has a great respect for working closely with nature, and this is why he has always worked on a model called sustainable development and culture. Laos, he always say, you know, everyone who talks about Laos, they only talk about how poor Laos is. Every article you read in Laos, every journal starts with a sentence, Laos is the poorest country in Southeast Asia. And he always says, Laos is not that poor. Laos is cash poor. Yes, people don't have money in their pocket, but Laos is a rich country. It's culturally rich. It has strong community cohesion. The people care about one another. And it has great wealth in its natural resources. And that is what he has always pushed for. And then the other pillar is, because of his influence by engaged Buddhism, he always talked about, in whatever we do, spirituality, your moral compass should be at the heart of development. So he has always used this four pillars as his so-called development model. And that will be the strong house. He said, any of these pillars, if you don't develop it, you won't have a stable house. Over the years, working on education, working on young people, he comes out with this. Education of the heart is the heart of education. He believed that knowledge is not enough. He believed that you have to really bring spirituality back into whatever you do as a guiding principle of all aspects of our work. Now, I quickly go through the abduction. That was what happened. This is a series of pictures captured on CCTV. Andrew referred to it. That evening, he was driving. We were driving home. I was in a car in front of him. He was driving in his beat-up Jeep, following me all the way until we passed the police post. And here, you can see the pictures are fuzzy because these are not from the original CCTV footages. We copied it, we filmed it with a smartphone and camera taken off the TV monitor when we were viewing it. We were not allowed to take the original tape. You can see here, this is the policeman stopping him, asking at that time what I assume was for his documents. Normally when the police stops you at the police post to check your documents, you hand over the documents, they check it, and they return it to you. The next series of pictures, and this is just the key photos, shows somebody getting out of his vehicle. He was obviously asked to get out of the vehicle, and he went into the police post. The police post is a bit dark because it was at that time about 6:30. Next, we saw a man riding a motorbike, came in front of the Jeep, parked his motorcycle there, got down, went into the police post, see, and came back out, got into the Jeep, and drove the Jeep away. Sombat was nowhere to be seen, presumably still inside the police post. The next series of footages shows here the policeman standing there waiting for something. He's actually waiting for this white truck. The white truck came with flashing lights, stopped in front of the police post, and the next thing was fuzzy again, fuzzy photographs that show three figures getting into this white truck, and the truck was driven away. That was the last time I saw somebody, 15 months ago. Okay? I don't know why. I can't explain it, because his work has always been in the open. Andrew has talked about it. He had worked openly. Openly, he's not as though he was running any kind of underground activity, or, you know, people have called him a political activist and this and that. He has organized protests. He did not. He knew the importance of working with different segments of society, including government partners. And in fact, he always advised other NGO workers who come in and they want to do their own work, we want to help the community, he said, you have to get your program approved. And he has worked in the open. He worked with partners at the central level, the provincial level, and at the district level, and even in the village. And very often, government officials accompanied him down to the communities where he worked, attended the training sessions, were there. So his work was always in the open. There were speculations about what could have triggered the abduction. Many people say it could be because of the role, the prominent role he had played in helping to organize the Asia-Europe People's Forum. The Asia-Europe People's Forum is a forum for civil society that takes place prior to the official Asia-Europe Summit meeting. The intention of the forum is to gain and get voices from civil society to feed into the official summit meeting. And so, Sombat was asked, requested by the government and by NGOs to co-chair this event. I had actually asked him, is it wise, given the context of Laos? He said it is an opportunity. It's the opportunity to engage civil society, to get their inputs into the summit. And as part of the preparation, there were consultations with different groups across the country, with different age groups, segments, and this is a photograph where the issues on, you know, what are your challenges, what are development challenges you face, what are your aspirations, and there was a very hands-on participatory workshop process where he got a lot of the inputs from different segments of Lao society. This photograph actually shows the closing ceremony of the Asia-Europe's People's Forum, in which this man here is the Vice Minister for Foreign Affairs, who actually thanked Sombat profusely for organizing. So people say it could be due to his role. I don't know, because the government hasn't told me. But what is interesting, not interesting, what was devastating actually was at the forum itself, there were issues, some sensitive issues were raised. Issues related to land, issues related to water. Sombat, being the organizer, actually wasn't a speaker in any of this forum. But at the forum itself, we saw a very large security presence of plainclothes security officers attending, taking photographs, taking notes. Soon after that, one of the key organizers and representatives of Helvetas, which is a Swiss-based international NGO organization, who sponsored some of the participants from the villages to come attend the conference, and her villagers who came up spoke about issues of land grabbing, spoke about how their land was misappropriated. When the villagers returned to the home village, they were harassed. And Anne-Sophie Jindos tried to raise the issue with key government officials to stop the harassment. Soon after that, on December 7, Anne-Sophie Jindos was expelled from the country. At that time, Sombat and I were not even in the country. We were in Myanmar. We got back to Vientiane on the 10th of December. Sombat was abducted on the 15th of December. The government has stated in their official statements that the state is not responsible. Okay? For as far as I'm concerned, I don't care who has taken him. It's the state responsibility to go after the perpetrators. If the state says that Sombat could have been kidnapped, go after the kidnappers. Return Sombat safely. That is what I and the family want. Andrew has already talked about the aftermath and the impact on Laos civil society. There's a wall of silence and there's great fear among civil society groups. From a personal perspective, the last 15 months have been very, very difficult. Disappearances is one of the most major human rights violations. In fact, people who work in this area call it the mother of human rights violations. If a person has been killed, the person dies once. A disappeared person for the family dies every day. I don't want this kind of things to happen to anybody. Nobody should ever be disappeared, because we are all left to live in agony, live with uncertainty. Many people ask me, well, you know, Laos have been a signatory of many human rights conventions. And indeed, Laos is one of the earliest signatories of the UN Convention Against Enforced Disappearance. So I'm here urging the good people of Australia, urging the Australian government with good relations in Laos to please support the Find Sombat campaign. Don't let Sombat disappear. really disappear. We need him to come home. For those of you who, this may be new to you, a website has been established for anyone, all information about this, about Sambat's work, about what happened, and all the press reports have been posted on this website. This call is on the website www.sambat.org. Visit the website and support the campaign. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you very much, Shrimi, for that very personal story. You'll have an opportunity to ask some questions of Shrimi, and we'll open up the conversation shortly. Before we do that, we wanted to take this very specific story and put it in a broader context of what's happening in human rights in the region more broadly. And so to that end, we've invited along Andrew Beswick, who is the Director of Community Engagement and Media Relations with Amnesty International Australia. So we'll invite Andrew to talk about the, as I said, the happenings in the region, and in particular the engagement that Amnesty's having to seek to make a difference there. And then after that we'll open up for a discussion with the panel. So, Andrew.
Thanks, Adam. And thank you for the interest of organising this evening. And of course, my respects to Shrimi for the fantastic, I guess, journey that you're on. I also want to acknowledge the traditional owners of this country. This has and always will be Aboriginal land. I guess, yes, just to put the situation into a broader context, so it is a worldwide phenomenon in forced disappearances. And to give you a sense of what it's like, it often works like this. Some men come and force their way into a family home. They come any time of the day, but it's often in the middle of the night. They're usually in plain clothes, sometimes they're in uniform, but they're always carrying weapons. They don't give any reason, and they don't produce an arrest warrant, and they frequently don't say whose authority they're acting on, but they will drag someone away and I take them into a car, using violence if necessary. Sometimes in Sondland's case, people are simply taken off the street. And very often, the people who have disappeared, we simply don't know their fate. And as we've heard today, the families and the friends often wait a very long time to find out what's happened to them. But the person hasn't vanished. Someone somewhere knows what's happened to them. And this is very much the situation in Sondland's case. Someone is responsible. It's particularly cruel human rights violation because, as Shrimi has talked about, it's a violation not just of the person who has been disappeared, but also of their family and their friends. For the person themselves, they often live in constant fear for their life while they are in detention at the mercy of their captors. And it's a continuing violation that can persist for many years. And as we heard earlier, it's not, for that reason, it's not just a one-off situation. And if they are eventually released, they quite often suffer the consequences for a long time afterwards, in terms of the impact on their physical and mental health. Adam talked about the convention, which is the legal, I guess, or the international law enforcement mechanism for enforced disappearances. In our region, Asia Pacific, only four countries have actually signed up to the convention. And unfortunately, Australia is not one of those. There is a UN working group on enforced disappearances, which meets several times a year. When they last published a report in 2012, some of the countries that were mentioned, a high number of outstanding cases of disappearance in Sri Lanka. There was 5,676 reported cases in Sri Lanka still outstanding. In the Philippines, there were 626. I can't remember through them all, but you'll see that 458 in Nepal, 428 in Timor still outstanding. There are many, many cases around the world. And in fact, when the working group last met, just last month, they examined another 600 cases in places such as Bangladesh, North Korea, Laos, Pakistan, Sri Lanka and Thailand. In Sri Lanka, since the civil war in May 2009, there have been a focus of efforts to help ensure there's international justice for the many people who were disappeared there during that time. And in fact, disappearances continue to take place in Sri Lanka. Amnesty International documented over 20 cases that took place in 2012, and one as recently as February 2012, which was a situation where a Tamil businessman was just 2 days before he was due to go to the Supreme Court to take forward a complaint about arbitrary arrest by the police, and then he was disappeared as a result of that pending court appearance, and he hasn't been seen since. And now we have a situation where people in Sri Lanka who are protesting disappearances are again subject to violence and intimidation. And last Human Rights Day in December, a group of about 25 people were attacked when they were trying to hold a vigil in support of people who had been disappeared and whose cases have not been investigated. So Amnesty International, along with the rest of the international community, is pushing to ensure that there is justice for those cases in Sri Lanka. In Indonesia, the military has a long case of enforced disappearances, and not just in the post-Suharto era, but in the post-Suharto era and the conflicts in Aceh, in Timor, in Papua. The cases are not as great in number now as they were then, but we do still continue to see cases where people are being detained without notice. Indonesia did sign the convention in September 2010, but we know that the cases continue to take place. As recently as last November, a man was taken from his home in North Sumatra by a military intelligence officer and 8 Marines, and he hasn't been seen since. The reason he was detained, apparently he was seen in the company of someone else who was known to have stabbed a soldier, and they wanted to find out what he knew. In China, of course, dissidents are frequently taken into custody, and we have, as is obviously famous, SARS, Ai Weiwei, and many other famous dissidents in China who have been disappeared for periods of time. There have been some reforms recently in China. There's been a situation where just last year, the Chinese authorities decided that they were going to reform the re-education through labour system, which is very good news for those people who have been, thousands of people have been subjected to Chinese forced labour camps. Unfortunately, what it's meant is that there are now more people that are actually being in informal detention than other means, either in unknown locations or simply disappeared. So the trends now have been away from the labour camps and towards these other mechanisms. So that's something that obviously, in the case of China, the window opens and the door closes, if you like. And there has also been legal reforms in China with the criminal procedures law. But in fact, while some of these have been good, and for example, you now have a situation where it's no longer legal to use evidence gathered under torture, Article 73 of the criminal procedure law actually enables legal enforced disappearance because it doesn't require the police to notify the family of the location of the detainee. And they can actually be detained in secret for up to 6 months. There are some governments in the region who have been taking steps to make improvements. Obviously, there was a long history of enforced disappearances in the Philippines in the Ferdinand Marcos dictatorship and in the years that followed that. And those do continue to take place as recently as 2012, and has documented cases. And certainly abuses by police continue to be documented by Amnesty to this day. But the good news is that in December 2012, Philippines did legislate against enforced disappearances. They passed what was called the Anti-Enforced or Involuntary Disappearance Act. So that law is actually forbids state agents from abducting people suspected of anti-government activity. and provides a maximum penalty of life imprisonment without amnesty for practice of enforced disappearances. So this is getting a very strong message from the Philippines government that they are wanting to change that practice in that country. And this is what's required for more governments if we're going to overcome this practice in the region. So what Amnesty is doing, we continue to campaign against enforced disappearances. We on every 30th of August, which is the International Day of Disappeared, Amnesty activists around the world take action in support of, in particular, people who have been disappeared and in solidarity with their relatives. In Sobrat's case, we did issue emergent action at the time of his detention, and there was another one at the 12-month anniversary last December. People who have been writing letters to the authorities continue to do that. We've also created an online action. If you go to the Amnesty International Australia website, amnesty.org.au, and search for Sobrat, you will find current urgent action on his case, where you can send a letter to the lower authorities. Sharon Ming earlier this week met with the Coin Group in Canberra, which is a group of activists, including ex-diplomats, who continue to work on Sobrat's behalf and held a protest at the Lao Embassy last December and the anniversary. And with our dealings with governments, including the Australian government and the Lao government, will continue to press home to ensure that those questions about where is Sobrat and can you please find him are continued to brought to the attention of diplomats. I guess just on a final note, I also want to mention that we do have success in the disappearance cases. Recently, one of the cases in the Ukraine, the protesters in Kiev have been taken off the streets and abducted for a number of days. Amnesty International has been successful in applying international pressure to ensure that those people are released and have been able to safely leave the country. So I know we're discussing brief, but a lot of the time we have been able to achieve real change, and we continue to work for cases such as some of that and to keep that pressure up.
Yeah. So we do now have some time to take questions from the audience. So anyone to start off with questions for any of our panelists tonight? Yes, thank you.
What can ordinary Australians do to help?
So what can ordinary Australians do to help? Sherman Landers.
Well, Andrew just mentioned that there's the Amnesty International campaign on Sobrat's disappearance. You can support that. I think it's also, you know, another thing that people can do is to write directly to the Lao government. I can provide an address of people that you can potentially write to if you're interested in doing that. Is another thing that people can do. Also, you could write to Julie Bishop, the Foreign Minister, and urge that the government take a stronger stance on Sobrat's disappearance.
But just to add to that, I think anybody who is able to be in touch with their local MPs are quite often valuable for ministers such as Julie Bishop to hear from local and any backbencher about what their constituents are concerned about.
Further questions?
Elaborate a little bit in terms of the base for civil society within the Lao context.
Civil society space in Laos has always been very limited. It's not, Andrew has already kind of sketched up the political context of Laos. Lao people do not get involved very much in politics because they don't see how they can. There are also laws and regulations that restrict assembly, freedom of speech. The press, there's no such thing for a free press. So it's very, very difficult for civil society to Laos is culturally, people are living in small communities with, and they don't want to make any trouble for anybody, you know. Many Laotians will tell me, oh, the best way to keep out of trouble is stay away from government. As long as government don't come and bother you, that's the best thing you can do. After just before Somat's disappearance, there seems to be a slight opening of civil society space in the sense that the government has issued a decree that allows for the registration of not-for-profit associations. Not-for-profit associations could be like NGOs, but they could be trade associations, they could be any form of associations, old people's associations, anybody can. Some, you know, civil society groups. The government has issued a decree, and because of a lot of pressure from the international community, that they would like to see a more greater involvement of civil society in Laos. Because of the decree, a number of small groups who want to do work with the community, whether this be in education or in rural development or in support for environmental protection or cultural rights, they have registered. But the registration process can take a long time. Up until Somat's disappearance, there were maybe about 60, 70 small associations registered. After Somat's disappearance, it sent such a chilling effect to Laos society, and Andrew has already described it. People inside Laos, basically, does not mention Somat, either directly or indirectly, because somebody might have told them, some government, people who work in the government or relatives to say, we better stay away from talking about Somat. We don't mention Somat because they felt that Somat could have done something which have incurred the ire of the state. So let's not get involved. So the Laos civil society groups can't put their heads down, not to mention, not to ask. Not only the Laos civil society groups, but also the international NGOs who work in Laos, including major NGO organizations, some of them are Australian-based, Oxfam, Australia Care, many of these groups did not want to get too involved in Somat's disappearance, because there is a sense that their work could be jeopardized. In Laos, in order to work in any area, whether this be development or any area of work, you have to get approval from the government. So many of the international NGOs also decided not to voice too much concern on the disappearance of Somat. There was a fear that if they were too engaged or too involved in asking about Somat, their organization may have its registration cancelled, they may lose their visa and therefore cannot stay in the country to work. The example of Anne-Sophie Jindrops was expelled from the country because of her vocal action in asking for to stop harassment for the Lao religion. They saw that example, and therefore a wall of silence has descended on Lao. Up to today. I think the NGO community finally got a letter out to the government expressing their concern for Somat's disappearance. Not every NGO has signed up. Only a number of the NGOs have signed up, and up to today. And as Andrew said, the Lao people are watching, even though they are not talking, they are not speaking about Somat, they are watching. The general sense is, if this could happen to Somat, it could happen. But the reverse is true. If the international community cannot do anything from somebody, then we cannot look for support from the international community either.
And in fact, that chilling effect is, one might say, the very reason for these sorts of disappearances, isn't it? It's not only about silencing or taking away Sombat personally, but it's about making an example to keep others in line, wouldn't you agree? That it's about other individuals and other NGOs and elements of civil society to remind them not to get out of line and not to rock the boat, because this could happen to you just as easily as it's happened to Sombat. Would you agree with that, Shreya?
Yes.
Yeah. And tragically, it's not only the phenomenon of enforced disappearance that's in play here, but also other forms of crackdown. Deregistration of NGOs is one that Shreering mentioned, and it's happening not only in Laos, but next door in Cambodia and elsewhere in the region as well, where there's this constant threat hanging over civil society to deregister NGOs, to deport foreigners, if they are indeed foreigners, and as far as the locals are concerned, if not enforced disappearance, then outright extrajudicial killing, protest against a land grab in Cambodia and see what happens to you. Chances are you may get shot, or if you're not shot, you may very well be arrested on trumped up charges and thrown in prison. And it's not a phenomenon which is peculiar to Cambodia. It's something that's happening tragically, you know, very often around the region. Any further questions for any of our panelists? Or I don't know, to comment on what I just said. Yes.
Just following up on what you just mentioned, what about Sombat's work? Has it also disappeared? Is it still striving?
Sombat has actually officially retired from the organization he established, the Participatory Development Training Center. His work has continued, and I must say that of all the different groups that operate in Laos, the people who have worked with Sombat showed the greatest courage. They continue to farm
their local
villages. I mean the local, but also the staff, Badek staff. Badek, the new director who has taken over, who was his deputy director, and the young people who have continued to work in Badek, they continue to carry the activities. It's not easy. They have to struggle like any other organization. They have a great love for somebody. And they say they are continuing in whatever way they can.
I might ask another question, if I may. The first question we had was, what can ordinary Australians do? Another question is, what can the Australian government do to take action in this case? Are there avenues with regard to leveraging Australia's aid program, for example? Are there avenues for Australia raising this case and the phenomenon of enforced disappearances through, for example, the Universal Periodic Review in the Human Rights Council? Are there other diplomatic stands that Australia could take? What would you advocate the Australian government ought to do?
I'm not Australian. I don't know what to tell your government to do or not to do. I have come here basically to talk to people and including the representatives so that they understand the case a little bit better. And I have stressed in my discussions that Australia is a valued ally of Laos. Australia provides a lot of development assistance to the country, but also it has a lot of investments, especially in the mining sector. Australia regards Laos as an important ally, a trading partner, but Laos depends a lot also on Australia. Australia government provides a lot of scholarships to Laos students to study here, including Laos government officials to study here. Now, whether the government can use that leverage a little bit better, on the case of Sombat, but also on broader human rights issues, because your government has a very strong statement related to human rights in your mission and vision statement in your corporate. I only ask that that the Australian government please do not let Sombat's case go away. It has to be still an important issue for diplomatic relations and for bilateral relations. How they do it, I don't know. I'm not a diplomat. They know that the ways to engage. Maybe Andrew has some other things.
Yeah, well, I am an Australian citizen, so it is my job to tell the government what I think they should do. I mean, lots of issues have been discussed in the meetings we've had. I don't want to go into details about those. Obviously, the periodic review is one thing. There's various other things that could be done. One of the issues I think might be pertinent, one of the debates I think that might be pertinent to tonight, what I assume is a legal crowd of lawyers and students, is something that came up in the seminar we had at the ASU. One of the papers was, what does this mean for the huge amount of Australian development assistance that goes into things like good governance, law and order, those sorts of things? I mean, this has been a component, an increasing component of Australia's aid program since, I suppose, about the mid-90s, when the whole good governance sort of craze kicked off, and obviously good governance is an incredibly important thing. I'm not belittling that for a moment. But to what degree has that become a tick-the-box exercise, both on the part of the governments that provide it in the West, the technical experts that administer it, and of course the governments on the receiving end, who all play a sort of game ticking the box about good governance, and then things like this happen? I think it really asks fundamental questions about this. I mean, this is something that I need to do a little bit more looking into, but I believe, for example, that Australia provides funding to the Lao police. I know we provide funding to good governments. Obviously, there's direct questions around Sombat's disappearance and this and the effectiveness of that aid, but there's also broader questions around exactly what are we doing in the sort of good governance program and the Australian aid program, which is an increasingly large component of overseas aid. I used to work for the Australian Council for Overseas Aid back in the 90s, and I would have been able to list off exactly what the percentage of the aid budget good governance sort of is. I can't do that now, but I'm sure it's still a very significant proportion. I don't know if anyone in the legal fraternity or law students have any views about that.
Andrew, you're government liaison, Rob, if you want to comment on the broad question of the sorts of things, generally speaking, that the government might be encouraged to do, to take action?
Yes, so Andrew mentioned the Universal Periodic Review, so each country comes up before the United Nations Human Rights Council on a regular basis, and it's an important role, I think, of organisations like Amnesty and Fat Casting as well, to provide input into those reviews by the Human Rights Council, and it does provide an opportunity to provide some leverage on governments there, and also for governments such as Australia to hold other governments to account. So you know, we'll be able to make use of those kinds of opportunities, and also I think working with the role that we're playing in ASEAN and the role that ASEAN nations play in influencing Laos, I think probably more directly the ASEAN nations themselves influencing Laos and their aspirations to be a good international citizen. The mechanisms for the ASEAN human rights framework are still fairly weak, but there's an opportunity there to have that dialogue and to strengthen that. So
I also think, I don't want, just very briefly, I'm not suggesting any kind of aid conditionality or aid rollback. That's not something that we're talking about. It's not something that would probably work in the case of Sombat anyway. I mean, it's, Shreemin has stressed many times in some of the meetings, the softly approach has yielded no results for Sombat. The more robust approach of the European Union has yielded no results either. So obviously we need to think about other things. Certainly I would be keen for the Australian government to have as I say, as Schwimming suggested, to leverage off that relationship and look at how we can use that to try and influence sections of the government who may be more amenable to getting a resolution to this.
There's one more question. We might make this the final question for tonight.
I can't speculate on why. He's been working in the open for 30 years. His popularity was not just in 2010 or 2011. He has always been openly working. So I...
On that note, I think we might bring proceedings to a close. So I want to thank in particular Shui Ming for giving what must be a very difficult personal tale for her. And to thank her in particular for putting a human face, a human story to what would otherwise be a broad abstract discussion of yet another pressing human rights issue. So it's good to be reminded that there are individuals who are at the centre of each and every one of these thousands and thousands of cases that Andrew Beswick mentioned. So thank you, a very special thank you to you for your personal story. But I also want to thank our other panellists, Andrew Nessie, bringing Truman to us, and Andrew Beswick from Amnesty as well. So can you join me in thanking all of our panellists?